According to the peppered moth of legend, when pollution first began to blacken tree trunks in industrial England in the mid-19th century, the once pale moths turned black. It was theorized that light moths against sooty tree trunks were easily spotted by birds and eaten, while the dark moths evaded predators and survived to reproduce. A new black-peppered moth had evolved, just as Darwin said it would. Thus began the secular left's short-lived love affair with air pollution. It wasn't a particularly dazzling example of evolution. Black, white, or purple, they were still peppered moths. Nothing new was created. The moths didn't become birds or grow opposable thumbs or develop a capacity for introspection. The miracle engine of natural selection had merely produced a minor variation within the species of animals known as moths. New Yorkers not only transform from pale to dark, but also from fat to skinny during the annual summer migration to the Hamptons, and no one writes scientific articles about that. This is not the sort of metamorphosis that turns a mosquito into a German shepherd. Still, it was something, and the Darwiniacs didn't have much. Until the peppered moth, evolution fetishists had not been able to produce a single example of natural selection in real time. Here, at last, a light gray moth had been magically transformed into an altogether different and distinct life form, a slightly darker gray moth. Voila! Evolutionists were so excited about the peppered moth's changing hue, they couldn't be bothered with testing the theory. It had to be true. The Darwiniacs happily announced that the peppered moth proved evolution and presumably went back to calling critics of evolution anti-science know-nothings. It wasn't until the early 50s that anyone thought to test the theory. Oxford biologist E.B. Ford sent his assistant out to capture hundreds of the moths and stage an experiment. For 2 years, black moths were bussed out of the inner city areas to the suburbs, while white moths were bussed into the inner city areas. Then both groups were monitored to see how long each survived. Is it just me, or does this scenario sound oddly familiar? After 2 years of observation, Ford triumphantly announced that birds easily spotted light moths on black city trees and dark moths on the light country trees. There it was. Evolution was proved. For the next 50 years, the peppered moth experiment was a major part of the mountains of evidence for evolution referred to by Scientific American. Evolution fundamentalist Jerry Coyne called the peppered moth the prize horse of natural selection. Every schoolchild has seen the photo of the light peppered moth clearly visible on a black tree trunk next to a photo of the dark moth nearly invisible against the same tree trunk. It was so logical, so intuitive, and so fake. Decades later, researchers who had not been informed by the editors of Scientific American or Judge John Jones III that questioning evolution was a hanging offense noticed some problems. American lepidopterist Ted Sargent and others pointed out that peppered moths do not rest on tree trunks, but on the undersides of high branches. Not only that, but the peppered moth sleeps during the day, coming out to fly only at night when the birds are asleep. It turned out Ford and his assistant had rigged the game by physically placing light moths on black tree trunks in the bright light of day, someplace the moths would never have been if left to their own devices. It was rather like testing the theory that birds developed wings to avoid sharks by dumping wingless birds into a shark tank and seeing if they survived. As described in the New York Times, the most famous example of evolution in action must now become the most infamous. But what about those photos? The famous photos of the peppered moths were staged, often by literally gluing dead moths to tree trunks. Their proof of evolution was suddenly reduced to a variation on Monty Python's dead parrot sketch. I took the liberty of examining that parrot when I got it home, and I discovered the only reason that it had been sitting on its perch in the first place was that it had been nailed there. Now let's examine how evolutionists responded. You know, the ones who claim to be slaves to the scientific method. Except for a thimbleful of serious scientists who admitted the jig was up, the cult members wholly ignored the truth about the peppered moth. They demonized Sargent, the lepidopterist who had exposed the fraud, marginalized his work, and attempted to ruin his career. To this day, evolutionists cite the peppered moths as proof that evolution is based on science. The staged photos still appear in biology textbooks, as detailed in Jonathan Wells's book, Icons of Evolution. An article in The New Scientist on July 9, 2005, authoritatively stated, "Evolutionary biologists have long known that the process can happen rapidly. Charles Darwin himself pointed out the observable changes wrought by pigeon fanciers and dog breeders. A century later, biologists showed that peppered moths in England's industrial heartland had evolved darker colors to camouflage themselves against soot-blackened trees. Maybe the new name for the new scientist should be the 1950s scientist. And I don't think selective breeding directed by a human being goes in the hidden hand of nature column. Also in 2005, 3 years after it had been acknowledged in the New York Times that the peppered moth example was a fraud, University of Rochester biology professor H. Allen Orr wrote an article in The New Yorker treating the peppered moth scandal as an open question. Did the peppered moth evolve dark color as a defense against birds, or for other reasons? And what role, if any, did the several empty cans of black spray paint found at the scene play in their evolutionary odyssey? Orr called the darkening of the peppered moth one of the minor squabbles among evolutionary biologists that had been inflated by skeptics of evolution. Peppered moths sleep during the day. They fly at night. They do not normally alight upon tree trunks. These are observable facts, sort of like the Earth revolving around the sun. It would be as if a college professor had lightly dismissed the minor squabble among scientists about whether it's possible to sail off the edge of the Earth and denounced critics of the flat Earth theory as fanatical pro-elliptical orbists. What is so peculiar about the Darwiniacs is that they perpetrate comical frauds in defense of their religion and then angrily accuse their opponents of being driven by religious zeal. They're constantly acting like you're the idiot for refusing to admit the fact that we're living on the back of a giant turtle. At least the evolutionists still had the embryo drawings. Almost every biology book for the past century has included pictures of vertebrate embryos made by German biologist and enthusiastic eugenicist Ernst Haeckel, purportedly demonstrating the amazing similarity of fish, chickens, and humans in the womb. Without the Darwinist priesthood to explain, it's not clear what this proved in the first place. It seems that Haeckel believed the development of the embryo imitated an organism's entire evolution as a species, a theory precisely as scientific as molding an animal out of Play-Doh and claiming that you have just demonstrated how God made the animals. Haeckel's other big contribution to science, by the way, was the scientific claim that woolly-haired Negroes were psychologically nearer to the mammals, apes and dogs, than to civilized Europeans, and therefore we must assign a totally different value to their lives. If Haeckel's imaginative theory were true, then he could show what humans looked like 500 million years ago by pointing to a fertilized human egg. And he could show what humans looked like, say, 100 million years ago by showing a baby in the second trimester. And he could show what humans looked like 1 million years ago by pointing to James Carville. Finally, and most important, if his wackadoodle theory were true, then Haeckel could prove all vertebrates evolved from a similar-looking organism 500 million years ago. I note in passing, evolution would still not explain why some of us became humans and others never made it past the gecko stage. You can see why the scientific community sat up and took notice at this point. The last scientific theory to generate this kind of buzz was alchemy. Amazingly enough, according to Haeckel's drawings, vertebrate embryos did look alike. To give you a sense of the mountains and mountains of evidence supporting the theory of evolution, until Haeckel's drawings turned out to be frauds, his crackpot theory constituted one of the main pieces of evidence in support of evolution. Charles Darwin himself said the facts in embryology were second to none in importance and by far the strongest single class of facts supporting his theory. And then, in the 1990s, British embryologist Michael Richardson was looking at vertebrate embryos through a microscope and noticed that they look nothing at all like Haeckel's drawings. Richardson and his team of researchers examined vertebrate embryos and published actual photos of the embryos in the August 1997 issue of the journal Anatomy and Embryology. It turned out that Haeckel had used the same woodcuts for some of the embryos and doctored others to make sure that the embryos looked alike. "It looks like," Richardson said, "it's turning out to be one of the most famous fakes in biology, which, in a field crowded with other evolutionary proofs, was quite a claim." After Richardson published his photos of the embryos, the scientific community demonstrated its fearless commitment to the truth by completely ignoring his exposé. It turned out that Haeckel's drawings had been known to be fakes for a century. Stephen Jay Gould responded in the March 2000 issue of Natural History magazine, saying he had known all along, and yet the keepers of the state religion had kept mum. Fully 5 years later, the New York Times reported that biology textbooks were still running Haeckel's doctored drawings. The Times specifically singled out the third edition of Molecular Biology of the Cell, the bedrock text of the field, as one of the culprits. Caught red-handed hawking fake evidence, one of the authors of the bedrock text justified the use of the Haeckel fakeries with the sort of pompous non sequitur you always get from the cult members. He said, "Haeckel's drawings were overinterpreted." If they were fakes, why were they being interpreted at all? Why were they still in his textbook? If it took evolutionists 50 years to notice the "Ask me about my pre-human grandchildren" decal on the back of Piltdown Man's skull, needless to say, the Darwiniacs aren't giving up just because Haeckel's drawings were fake. You're probably asking yourself, why would the New York Times be printing the truth? The only reason the Times even mentioned the continued publication of Haeckel's phony drawings was to complain that the fakery was helping intelligent design proponents who were screaming from the rooftops about the long-running hoax. As the Times said, Intelligent Design has helped its cause by publicizing some embarrassing mistakes in leading biology textbooks. The article concluded with this stirring declaration of faith. Biologists say the findings do not shake their confidence in the theory of evolution. No evidence will ever shake their confidence in the theory of evolution. Then there was the famous Miller-Urey experiment in 1953, which seemed to recreate the beginnings of life in a test tube. In a genuinely groundbreaking experiment, scientists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey reconstructed what was thought to be the Earth's early atmosphere. They sent a spark of electricity through the primordial soup and, wham, simple amino acids appeared. They had produced the building blocks of life with the laboratory equivalent of a bolt of lightning. It could only be a short step to discovering how life came from non-life on the early Earth. Next stop, David Hasselhoff in a test tube. The first problem to arise was that for the next 20 years, scientists couldn't get close to the next step, which was to produce proteins. Simple amino acids aren't even proteins, much less life, so the bridge between non-life and life remained elusive. The primitive building blocks created by Miller have no proven pathway to life. Still, it was something. But the real fly in the primordial soup arose in the early 70s, when geochemists realized that the Earth's early atmosphere was probably nothing like the gases used in the Miller-Urey experiment. Miller-Urey's experiment used an atmosphere modeled on what we knew of Jupiter, composed of methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water. In the 1970s, geochemists discredited this theory of the Earth's early atmosphere and concluded that it probably contained more carbon dioxide, almost no hydrogen, and possibly some oxygen. Creation of even simple amino acids would have been impossible in such an environment. As Miller himself has said, either you have a reducing atmosphere, i.e., with lots of hydrogen atoms, or you're not going to have the organic compounds required for life. The revolutionary 1953 Miller-Urey experiment has been moot since the 70s. It proved nothing about the origin of life because the atmosphere assumed by the experiment was the opposite of what existed on ancient Earth. There is still no plausible account for the origins of life. You would think that fact might interest people who are always boasting that they are impartial scientists, going wherever the evidence leads them, with no ideological predispositions. Guess what is still taught in biology textbooks as proof of evolution? That's right, the 1953 Miller-Urey experiment. The Darwin cult has the audacity to compare the theory of evolution to Einstein's theory of relativity, saying that it is just a theory too. Okay, but when Einstein announced his theory of general relativity, he also offered a series of empirical tests that would prove it false. That's what made it a scientific theory, and not, say, an astrological profile. If light had not appeared to bend away from the sun during the 1919 solar eclipse, or if his equations could not account for Mercury's orbit around the sun, Einstein would have abandoned the theory. In the end, of course, his theory accounted for both phenomena and has been repeatedly retested and proved true. By contrast, Darwin imagined a mechanism that would account for how life in its infinite variety might have arisen and offered a non-disprovable standard to test his theory. You will recall, Darwin's test for his theory was this. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. The great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, said, "Any theory that cannot conceivably be refuted is not science. The very fact that it is non-disprovable is an immunizing stratagem, distinguishing pseudoscience from real science. Either there is no evidence that could possibly disprove Darwin's theory of evolution, or it has been disproved for about half a century. So it's possible that Darwin produced an actual scientific theory, but his disciples have turned it into a pseudoscience by their refusal to admit it can be, and has been, disproved." The evolutionist's other great contribution to the scientific method is to cite obvious, undisputed facts having nothing to do with evolution and brandish them as if they've just grown John Travolta from an earthworm. A masterful example is this inane passage from the New York Times. "Nowhere has evolution been more powerful than in its prediction that there must be a means to pass on information from one generation to another. Darwin did not know the biological mechanism of inheritance, but the theory of evolution required one. Darwin may have been the classic scientific observer. He observed that individuals in a given species varied considerably, variations now known to be caused by mutations in their genetic code." The idea that Darwin was the first person ever to notice that traits were hereditary and that there was variation within a species is absolute lunacy. Even B.D., before Darwin, people noticed that their children looked like them, but not exactly like them, and they didn't understand the mechanisms of inheritance either. Yet the Times claims Darwin was the first to notice that information was passed from one generation to the next, and then boasts, "The discovery of DNA, the sequencing of the human genome, the pinpointing of genetic diseases, and the discovery that a continuum of life from a single cell to a human brain can be detected in DNA are all a result of evolutionary theory." Using the same logic, one could also claim that DNA, human genome sequencing, the discovery of genetic diseases, and the growth of the human brain are also a direct result of generations of humans saying, "Hey, look, little Billy has his father's nose." But we don't teach, "Hey, look, little Billy has his father's nose," as a groundbreaking scientific discovery. The same article reports that Darwin also realized that constraints of food and habitat sharply limited population growth. Not every individual could survive and reproduce. Will Darwin's wondrous feats never end? Darwin's The Origin of Species was published in 1859. About 10 years after the Irish potato famine killed 1 million people and drove another million to flee the country, 1845-48. I believe other people besides Darwin may have noticed that the absence of food limited population growth. Darwin's innovation was that mutation plus death would produce a new species. And yet, the Irish are still Irish. The only new species we got out of the Irish potato famine was the blight-resistant Idaho potato, invented by intelligent designer Luther Burbank, American plant breeder. The only evidence for Darwin's theory of evolution is fake evidence, and every time Darwiniacs are caught hawking fake proof, they complain that it's merely a gap in the theory. The Darwiniacs play a shell game with the evidence, but the evidence is never under any of the shells. The point isn't that school children should be taught the controversy. School children should be taught the truth. This includes the truth about the entire fossil record, which shows a very non-Darwinian progression, noticeably lacking the vast number of transitional species we ought to see. The truth about the Cambrian explosion, in which virtually all the animal phyla suddenly appeared, with no Darwinian ancestors. The truth about the Galapagos finch population, changing not one bit since Darwin first observed the finches more than 170 years ago. The truth about the peppered moth experiment. The truth about Haeckel's embryos being a fraud perpetrated by a leading German eugenicist. The truth about the Miller-Urey experiment being based on premises that are no longer accepted. The truth about the non-existence of computer simulations of the evolution of the eye. These aren't gaps in a scientific theory. There is no scientific theory. There is only a story about how a bear might have fallen into the ocean and become a whale. As Colin Patterson asked, what is any one true thing about evolution? In the end, evolutionists' only argument is contempt. The cultists know that if people were allowed to hear the arguments against evolution for just 60 seconds, all would be lost. So they demonize the people making those arguments. You're just saying that because you believe in God. You probably believe in a flat earth, too. You sound like a Holocaust revisionist. That's all you ever get. The evolutionists' self-advertisements paint a different picture. A New York Times review of a book on intelligent design summarized the situation this way. As Michael Ruse points out, modern science's refusal to cry miracle when faced with explanatory difficulties has yielded fantastic dividends. Letting divine causes fill in wherever naturalistic ones are hard to find is not only bad theology, it leaves you worshiping a god of the gaps, but it is also a science stopper. Far from chastely refusing to acknowledge miracles, evolutionists are the primary source of them. These aren't chalk-covered scientists toiling away with their test tubes and Bunsen burners. They are religious fanatics for whom evolution must be true and any evidence to the contrary, including, for example, the entire fossil record, is something that must be explained away with a fanciful excuse, like, our evidence didn't fossilize. Meanwhile, and by stark contrast, intelligent design scientists do not fill the gaps with God. They simply say intelligence is a force that exists in the universe, and we can see its effects and what it does. In Behe's flagellum, in the Cambrian explosion, in Gould and Eldridge's punctuated equilibrium. Evolutionists keep modifying their theory to say, assume a miracle, and the intelligent design scientists say, hey, does anyone else notice that it's always the same miracle? It's a miracle of design. Design in the universe may well be explained by something other than God, but we'll never know as long as everyone is required to pretend it's not there. To say intelligent design scientists are merely filling in the gaps with God is like saying Sir Isaac Newton filled in the gaps with the theory of gravity. He saw stuff dropping to the ground and tried to explain it. If only the Darwiniacs had been around, they could have told Newton, I don't see anything dropping. It's just an accident. Do you believe in God or something? Nor are intelligent design scientists looking at things they can't explain. Quite the opposite. They are looking at things they can explain, but which Darwin didn't even know about, like the internal mechanism of the cell, and saying, That wasn't created by natural selection. That required high-tech engineering. By contrast, the evolution cult members look at things they can't explain and say, "We can't explain it, but the one thing we do know is that there is no intelligence in the universe. It must have been random chance, or it's not science." Chapter 10. The Scientific Method of Stoning and Burning. The single greatest victory of the Darwiniacs is in the realm of rhetoric, not science. They have persuaded the slumbering masses that anyone who questions the theory of evolution must do so out of religious fervor. No matter what argument you make against evolution, the response is, "Well, you know it's possible to believe in evolution and believe in God." Yes, and it's possible to believe in Spider-Man and believe in God, but that doesn't prove Spider-Man is true. I admire the rhetorical technique and plan to use it during all future disputes. "Your time is up on the Stairmaster. You're just saying that because you believe in God." "This is the express checkout lane." "Oh, I get it. You believe in God." The August 24, 2005 New York Times was required to run this amusing correction. A front-page article on Sunday about the Discovery Institute, which promotes the concept known as intelligent design to explain the origins of life, referred incorrectly to the religious affiliation of the Institute's fellows. Most are conservative Christians, including Roman Catholics and evangelical Protestants, not fundamentalist Christians. Liberals can make dazzling distinctions between different types of Muslims. Osama bin Laden, for example, was a fundamentalist who would never have worked with a secular Muslim like Saddam Hussein, although liberals think Osama was willing to suspend his principles long enough to work hand in glove with Ronald Reagan. But anyone who questions evolution is ipso facto a fundamentalist Christian. The intelligent design movement is exactly the opposite of what the Darwiniacs would have you believe. Far from six-fingered lunatics handling snakes and speaking in tongues, the ID proponents are the real scientists, biochemists, astrophysicists, chemists, and mathematicians. As Behe says, intelligent design has been around since Aristotle, and its rising fortunes have been boosted by discoveries principally in physics and astronomy, such as the life-sustaining coincidences of the universe discovered by astronomers like the late Cambridge astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle. Bill Dembski has developed complicated mathematical formulas for detecting design in the universe, as distinct from chance or accident. Dembski has a doctorate in mathematics from the University of Chicago and a Master of Divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary. He has done postdoctoral work in mathematics at MIT, in physics at the University of Chicago, and in computer science at Princeton. He has held National Science Foundation graduate and postdoctoral fellowships. When faculty members at Baylor University erupted in rage at the research center Dembski had started up at the university to test theories of design in the universe, not one professor on the committee investigating Dembski could understand the mathematical arguments he had made. But just to be safe, they abolished his research center anyway. In an article in the New York Times on intelligent design, the design proponents quoted in the article keep rattling off serious scientific arguments, from Behe's examples in molecular biology to Dembski's mathematical formulas and statistical models. The Times reporter, who was clearly not trying to make the evolutionists sound retarded, was forced to keep describing the evolutionists' entire retort to these arguments as, "Others disagree." That's it. No explanation, no specifics, just others disagree. The high priests of evolution have not only forgotten how to do science, they've lost the ability to formulate a coherent counter-argument. You keep waiting to hear a serious response to arguments by people like Behe, Dembski, and Hoyle, but the evolutionists just scream that evolution is a fact, and if you don't believe it, you must be a fundamentalist who believes the Earth is flat. Which is rather presumptuous considering the scientific standing of the typical evolutionist. Their grandiose self-conceptions to the contrary, the cult members are rarely scientists at all. They're almost always biologists, the science with the greatest preponderance of women. The distaff MIT scientist who fled the room in response to Larry Summers' remarks was, of course, a biologist. While I'm sure there have been groundbreaking discoveries about the internal digestive system of the earthworm, biologists are barely even scientists anymore. They're classifiers, list makers, like librarians with their Dewey Decimal System. Except librarians don't claim the Dewey Decimal System holds the Rosetta Stone to the universe. There were once great biologists, but the morally vacuous ones began to promote their own at the universities. It was a sort of intelligently designed devolution. Like Marxists gradually dominating the comp-lit department, biologists will only be given tenure today if they forswear any doubts about the evolution pseudoscience. Consequently, biologist almost always means evolutionary biologist, which is something like an ESP biologist. Curiously, the science writers at the New York Times, as opposed to opinion writers like Paul Krugman or style section reporters writing about girl crushes, have generally been extremely circumspect in what they say about evolution. The principal source for idiotic statements about the overwhelming evidence for the theory of evolution in the Times is letters to the editor. Writing a letter to the New York Times is what people who don't fight think of as fighting. That's it. I'm writing a letter. Why, I'll take him to court. One letter writer said evolution was a fact, equivalent to the fact that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. A woman doctor wrote in to say that DNA evidence shows our common heritage with the animals with whom we share this planet. And Elton John gave birth to Janet Reno. If little Miss Smarty Pants could prove common heritage from similar DNA, she'd be awarded the Nobel Prize. The only evolutionist who ever tried to answer questions about evolution was Stephen Jay Gould, which meant he had to keep conceding key points, so much so that Philip Johnson called Gould the Gorbachev of Darwinism. If you can ever get the cult past the argument that their opponents are fundamentalists, it's game over. I gather this is their strongest argument, since it's the only one you hear. When the Kansas State Board of Education decided to hold hearings to determine what school children should be taught about evolution, they sought the views of prominent evolution defenders. They invited evolutionary biologist Kenneth Miller of Brown University. They invited Eugenie Scott, keeper of the faith at the National Center for Science Education, a front group dedicated to banning any questioning of evolution. Liberals love organizations with names that are the opposite of the truth, like all the communist front groups with American, peace, and democracy in their titles. And they invited anyone at all from another organization devoted to banning discussion of evolution, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Not one of them was willing to defend evolution in a public forum. The evolution fanatics justified their disappearing act on the grounds that members of the school board did not have open minds. The people running things, Miller said, were people whose minds were already made up. This is as opposed to the minds of people who refuse to discuss the issue and keep suing to prevent anyone from challenging their theory. Miller admitted that the refusal to debate can be made to look as if you do not want to defend science in public, or you are too afraid to face the intelligent design people in public. But the real reason he refused to debate, he said, was that it was not a genuine debate. Evolution is true, and everyone else, please stop asking questions. Scott, of the American League for Peace and Democracy, remarked sadly that she had once debated critics of evolution. "I was one of the holdouts, saying, 'Yes, appear with these guys. Yes, tell them what is wrong with their ideas. Go to their conferences. Treat them like scholars.' Scott is to science what the Reverend Barry Lynn is to Christianity. And both are proud recipients of the Playboy Foundation's First Amendment Award for blocking the speech of religious people while not infringing on the right of overweight women to dance in public wearing only pasties." When the evolution skeptics refused to acquiesce to Scott's badgering, she concluded they were being dogmatic. "Our willingness to engage their ideas," Scott said, "was not being reciprocated." Scott had deigned to treat them like scholars, and yet they refused to capitulate. This is the liberal definition of an ideologue, someone who won't give in to them. Nazis can march in Skokie, Democrats can fill the airwaves with treason, and Air America Radio can give Randy Rhodes access to literally hundreds of listeners every day, but the teaching of alternative theories to evolution is prohibited by law. They would prefer it if heretics from the official state religion could be put in prison and burned at the stake like Giordano Bruno. A good example of the Darwiniacs' willingness to engage others' ideas occurred when a small school district in Pennsylvania proposed to read a statement to high school biology students mentioning intelligent design. The statement read as follows: "The Pennsylvania academic standards require students to learn about Darwin's theory of evolution and eventually take a standardized test of which evolution is a part. Because Darwin's theory is a theory, it continues to be tested as new evidence is discovered. The theory is not a fact. Gaps in the theory exist for which there is no evidence. A theory is defined as a well-tested explanation that unifies a broad range of observations. Intelligent design is an explanation of the origin of life that differs from Darwin's view. The reference book, Of Pandas and People, is available for students who might be interested in gaining an understanding of what intelligent design actually involves. With respect to any theory, students are encouraged to keep an open mind. The school leaves the discussion of the origin of life to individual students and their families. As a standards-driven district, class instruction focuses on preparing students to achieve proficiency on standards-based assessments." That was it. Just an alluring reference to dissent from the official state religion that the students might look up in non-school hours. From the reaction of the evolutionists, you would think the Dover schools were teaching fisting to 12-year-olds, when, as any student knows, that's not covered until junior year. Going for his own Playboy First Amendment Award, Federal District Court Judge John E. Jones III ruled that this tepid statement violated the First Amendment of the United States Constitution by establishing a religion. The last person to demonstrate such mastery of the First Amendment was erstwhile Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers. Judge Jones, or as he came to be known, the well-respected Bush-appointed judge, had spent the better part of his career on a state liquor board determining such matters as that Zipper's gelatin shots may not be sold in Pennsylvania. But now he had a case that would get him noticed. As Jones confided to a New York Times reporter, when he saw the Dover Evolution case mentioned on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, he excitedly brought a copy home to his wife, telling her, "I'm on the cover of the Rolling Stone." At least he didn't pose for Vanity Fair in a Jaguar. At least not yet. The judge who had spent his career handing out T-shirts to Little Leaguers with catchy anti-drinking messages like, "Stop underage drinking, make the world a better place," concluded that alternative theories to evolution are unconstitutional. Jones wrote, "The fact that a scientific theory cannot yet render an explanation on every point should not be used as a pretext to thrust an untestable alternative hypothesis grounded in religion into the science classroom. Maybe some crazy scientific theory like quantum mechanics could be questioned, but not a rock-solid scientific theory that says a flying fish flew out of the ocean and became a bird. That's hard science. At least according to No Zipper Shots Jones, who held, it is unconstitutional to teach ID, intelligent design, as an alternative to evolution in a public school science classroom. The Times nearly ran out of fawning adjectives in its praise for Jones. Liberals hadn't been this alarmed by the activities at a high school since hearing about a high school football coach in East Brunswick, New Jersey, who allegedly prayed with his players for a good, clean game. In a single article, Jones was called a man of integrity and intellect, moderate, thoughtful, and universally well-regarded, and a Renaissance man. Needless to say, Jones was a lifelong Republican appointed to the federal bench in 2002 by President Bush. The Times still won't mention that John Ashcroft went to Yale, but it managed to work in that Judge Jones's father graduated from Yale. All you need to know about Jones's breadth of intelligence is that he calls Tom Ridge the singular inspiration of my life. This is the scientific method when it comes to the state religion. Rolling Stone magazine and Jason Blair's employer browbeat a hack judge into declaring the mere mention of alternatives to evolution unconstitutional. The cult loves to boast that there are no peer-reviewed articles on intelligent design, but then treats the publication of such an article as a fireable offense. Peer review is very important because otherwise you might have South Korean scientists claiming they've used cloning techniques to create embryonic stem cells, as Hwang Woo-suk did in a peer-reviewed paper published in the journal Science. Oops. In 2004, Richard Sternberg, PhDs in molecular biology and theoretical biology, published an article by Stephen Meyer, PhD in the history and philosophy of science from Cambridge University, in what the Washington Post described as the hitherto obscure journal Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington. Meyer's article was peer-reviewed by three renowned scientists and complied with all editorial requirements of the proceedings, according to a subsequent investigation by the U.S. Office of Special Counsel. Among Meyer's points was the one about the Cambrian period having no Darwinian antecedents, something your children are not allowed to hear about in high school. Apparently, the six readers of Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington weren't supposed to be told about the Cambrian period either. It wasn't ever clear whether Sternberg actually believed in the heretical doctrine of ID, but for permitting the publication of a peer-reviewed article about it, he was adjudged a witch and banished from the Smithsonian. The obscure journal disavowed the article, and Sternberg was warned not to come to future meetings. As is always the case with the witch burners, they went straight to Sternberg's sources of employment, demanding that he be fired. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel, which investigates retaliation against federal employees, was soon looking into the Smithsonian's treatment of Sternberg. The Smithsonian not only objected to any inquiry into intelligent design, it especially objected to any inquiry into its treatment of Sternberg. The independent counsel investigating the attacks on Sternberg issued a harsh report on the behavior of the alleged scientists at the Smithsonian and Eugenie Scott's National Center for Science Education. In her usual role as enforcer of the faith, Scott had led a campaign of vilification against Sternberg. Leaping to action like angry gay David Brock when he's cranky because he's retaining a lot of water and has just seen a Bill O'Reilly broadcast, the NCSE immediately posted hysterical responses to the Meyer article on its website. Scott's organization helped draft a repudiation of Meyer's article for the journal to print, and then turned around and cited that very repudiation as proof that the article should not have been published. The NCSE, the government report said, had worked closely with the Smithsonian in outlining a strategy to have Sternberg investigated and discredited. In the flurry of emails between the NCSE and the scientists at the Smithsonian Institution, Sternberg was accused of being a young Earth creationist. He was accused of taking money under the table to publish the article. His religion was investigated. He was accused of having no scientific training at all, but only training as an Orthodox priest. None of this was true. But, according to the independent counsel, the claim that Sternberg was not a scientist became so persistent that a colleague had to circulate his resume to dispel the rumor. Remember, he has PhDs in molecular biology and theoretical biology. The Smithsonian's chief spider torturer, Jonathan Coddington, began making inquiries about Sternberg's religious beliefs and politics, in particular, questioning if he was a fundamentalist or right-winger. Another scientist at the Smithsonian wrote in an email, "We are evolutionary biologists, and I am sorry to see us made into the laughingstock of the world, even if this kind of rubbish sells well in backwoods USA." Scott defended the inquiry into Sternberg's religious beliefs, saying, "They don't care if you are religious, but they do care a lot if you are a creationist. Sternberg denies it, but if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it argues for zealotry." "I'm no evolutionary biologist, but I think if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, that argues for it being a duck." The report concluded, retaliation came in many forms. Misinformation was disseminated through the Smithsonian Institution and to outside sources. The allegations against Sternberg were later determined to be false. The Smithsonian was unrepentant. Asked about the report by the Washington Post, Smithsonian spokesperson Linda St. Thomas said only, "We do stand by evolution. We are a scientific organization." Whatever else can be said of academics in cushy, comfortable jobs, they tend not to be big risk-takers. If this is what one Cambridge PhD goes through for publishing a peer-reviewed article simply because he dared question evolution, you can be sure we're not getting honest answers from the rest of the scientific community. One tends to hear about prominent academics who doubt evolution in the same hushed tones one hears about Hollywood actors who oppose abortion. Martin Sheen, Jack Nicholson, and Warren Beatty. You could have 10 times the IQ of Eugenie Scott, and most do, but if you gingerly raise scientifically based questions about evolution, you will be denounced as a creationist nut, your life will be turned upside down, and your employers will be hounded. You will probably be fired and certainly have to hire a lawyer. Now let's take a show of hands. Any Darwin skeptics? Good. Evolution has been proved again. The most fanatical defenders of evolution are not Harvard professors, curators at the American Museum of Natural History, or Times science reporters. They are cretinous high school biology teachers and liberal know-nothings trying to relive their fantasy of the Scopes trial. HBO documentary and family president Sheila Nevins says she doesn't shy away from such R-rated topics as G-string divas and taxicab confessions, but she complained of the imagined persecution she would face if she made a movie about Darwin. If HBO ran such a documentary, Nevin said, I'd get 1,000 hate emails. Maybe, but only from lonely guys upset about missing G-string divas. Evidently, it isn't that hard to make a fawning movie about Darwin in Hollywood. A partial list of movies and documentaries with Darwin's name in the title on the Internet Movie Database includes Darwin's Nightmare, 2004. Genius, Charles Darwin, 2003. Freud and Darwin Sitting in a Tree, 2000. Darwin's Evolutionary Stakes, 1999. A&E Biography, Charles Darwin, Evolution's Voice, 1998, TV. Darwin, 1997. Galapagos, Beyond Darwin, 1996, TV. Darwin, 1993, TV. Darwin on the Galapagos, 1983. Terre des Bêtes, Darwin, 1982, TV. The Voyage of Charles Darwin, 1978. The Darwin Adventure, 1972. Darwin Was Right, 1924. Felix Doubles for Darwin, 1924. Darwin, 1920. What Darwin Missed, 1916. A Disciple of Darwin, 1912. Cowardly people who run from the room crying at the idea that men and women could have different abilities in science like to play-act that they are John Scopes, speaking truth to power against hate-filled fundamentalist Christians, truth being defined as a discredited scientific theory from the Victorian age. They are like geeks playing air guitar in front of the mirror, pretending to be Keith Richards. Except there really is a Keith Richards. In fact, some scientists argue that Keith Richards is actually the missing link. The John Scopes of liberal imaginations never existed. In the great Hollywood tradition of All the President's Men, Aaron Brockovich, Silkwood, Good Night and Good Luck, and every single movie made by Oliver Stone, there are two separate and distinct stories, the one that actually happened and the movie version. Despite the raw fear that grips the Hollywood community at the thought of making a movie that reflects favorably on Darwin, there have been 4 movie versions of Inherit the Wind in 1960, 1965, 1988, and 1999. In the Book of Hollywood, it is taught that a brave high school biology teacher named John Scopes tried to educate his illiterate, toothless students in backwater Dayton, Tennessee, by teaching them science. For his trouble, he was nearly lynched by fundamentalist Christians, who stormed his classroom and arrested him on the spot for teaching Darwin's theory of evolution. As told in Inherit the Wind, clergymen and businessmen immediately threw Scopes in prison, where he remained throughout the trial, with fundamentalist Christians screaming that they would lynch him and throwing things at his window. Scopes was crucified, died, rose again, and now sits... No, wait, that's a different story. The real story of the Scopes trial is told in the book Summer for the Gods by Edward Larson. The Scopes trial was nothing but a publicity stunt. The idea for a trial on evolution was hatched by the ACLU in New York and seized upon by civic leaders in Dayton, Tennessee, as a way to drum up publicity for their town. Scopes was in on the prank, agreeing to be prosecuted even though he had never taught evolution and was not even a biology teacher. He did not spend 1 minute in jail, was never at risk of being sent to jail, was friends with the prosecutors, with whom he went swimming during the trial, and was even given a scholarship put together by the expert witnesses in gratitude for his star turn in the monkey trial. When the trial was over, the school offered to renew his teacher's contract. Darwin's theory of evolution was a hot topic in the summer of 1925, with lots of public debates on the subject. The theory of natural selection was being used to justify racialist theories, eugenics, and German militarism, which I seem to recall took a turn for the worse shortly thereafter, but I'd have to check my notes. The most important witnesses the defense considered calling as expert witnesses for the Scopes trial were all champions of forced eugenics. A few other state legislatures around the country had prohibited the teaching of evolution, but other state laws were merely prescriptive, with no punishment attached. Even in Tennessee, teaching evolution was only a misdemeanor offense, punishable by a nominal fine, much like drowning a girl in Massachusetts if your last name is Kennedy. The Scopes trial is, as Larson says, the most widely publicized misdemeanor case in U.S. history. The day the Tennessee governor signed the ban into law, he said it would never be enforced, and it never would have been, but for the bright idea of a native New Yorker who had recently moved to Dayton. Upon reading in a newspaper that the ACLU was offering to defend any Tennessee teacher who violated the law, George Rapaglia decided a trial on evolution would be a terrific way to get publicity for Dayton as a nice place to live and work, especially for busybody former New Yorkers with axes to grind. Rapaglia took his idea to the town elders assembled in the local drugstore, telling them that a trial on evolution would put Dayton on the map and boasting of his connections with the New York ACLU. Civic leaders warmed to the idea as a splendid way to promote the town, raising the possibility that they were serving more than milkshakes at the drugstore. Even the school superintendent, who had supported the law, liked the idea of a cooked-up trial as a way to get Dayton national recognition. The ACLU signed on, agreeing to pay the costs